I live in a house that has all wood floors. And so my wife doesn't have a lot of rugs.
Well, A, nice humble brag, and B, no, it sounds fine.
Yeah. Okay, great. So, well, what do you want to know? You have a list of questions, don't you? You want to ask me?
Yeah.
But we'll ease you. It'll trick you. It's like you put the frog in the cold water first.
Yeah, exactly. And crank up the heat.
Yeah, we slowly get through it. So how'd you get into this game?
Oh, God. Centuries ago, there were computers used to take up buildings. Sure. Now, I never wanted to be into computers, and but I liked electronics. And so when I got when I went to school, I took electrical engineering. So I always wanted to work on radio equipment, right? Mm-hmm. And it just so happened I got a job at a company called General Radio, which was renamed to Genrad. And that's where I actually got introduced to the mini computer. And this is showing my age, the PDP-8 from DEC,
cool.
Which was a 12-bit computer. And I was fascinated by what you could do with assembly language. Mm-hmm. And so that started a career that has infested my mind for the past number of years. So, so I worked at DEC. That's how I got associated with the, the alpha processor and all right. the other things. So it was a great company when I worked there. And then like all things come to an end.
Right.
And when I would say that from the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, DEC was riding high. And then as the 80s started closing out, it started losing its greatness because, you know, there was the young upstarts out here in on the West Coast, like Apple and Microsoft and that sort of thing. And we tried to adapt. One of the projects I got to work on very early on, around the same time the Macintosh came out, was a thing called the VAX workstation. Right. And it was basically, we take a MicroVAX and we slap a 128K frame buffer board into it and write some software. Oh, look, we have Windows. And with a really crappy quadrature mouse and a 19-inch... Oh, I had a display resolution of like 1024 by 864. It was a really weird resolution.
That's amazing for the time, though.
Yeah, it was. But it was a big 19-inch, video tube, and
yeah.
It was huge.
But, I mean, even then, just for some context, the concept of frame buffers was pretty new.
A
bitmap display was a pretty shiny thing, maybe a few years before that, 4 or 5 years before that, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you probably, if you know the history of digital, they dabbled in the PC market too, sort of the wrong approach. Their approach was, well, PCs are really mini computers in small boxes. And they created this line of computers called the Professional Series, which was based on the F11 PDP-11 chip. And they took RSX 11M, which was the operating system for the PDP-11, and put a textual menu system around it. And they called it Personal Operating System. I won't comment on the letters.
Ouch.
So we thought we could do better, especially with VAX coming out. And, the MicroVAX was being developed out in Seattle at DEC West. And there was a group within DEC who had developed this board for the PDP-11, which was a bitmap board. Mm-hmm. And we said, hey, well, your chocolate goes great with my peanut butter and my peanut butter goes great with your chocolate. And you put it together and you write some software and you actually had the beginning. What was the first program we had? VT100 emulator.
Perfect. Because when you got bitmap, that's what you want to do, right?
So you could have six of those open at a time. It was really, really cool. And so, it just progressed on that. And we built it became a really nice place to work because we were innovating. We had developed, you know, we took the power of a VAX 11780. I don't know if you've ever seen the size of one of those things in a computer room, but we put it into a shoebox that fit on your desk, you know, using the original VAX chip. The VAX Station 1 or the MicroVAX 1 and the VAX Station 1 used a discrete data path and CPU module that was developed out in Seattle. And the VAX Station, MicroVAX 2 and the VAX Station 2 used an actual chip that came out of DEC's semiconductor facility. And that was about the same power as a VAX 11780. And, you know, it's like, okay, we had really slow. I think the VAX Station 1, you could only have a couple of megabytes of memory. That was it. Mm-hmm. And the VAX Station 2 allowed you to have like 8 megabytes of memory. Ooh. And
that's huge though. That's huge.
That was huge back then. Considering the Macintosh had 128K, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's enormous. And this is still back in the day when, you know, places like HP and IBM, DEC, Digital Equipment Corporation, they did computers from soup to nuts kind of thing. They would design the chips and they would...
it was all vertically integrated, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the PC, Apple sort of broke that mold a little bit with the Apple II. And right. then the IBM sort of scrambled around with the PC and bought parts off the shelf. But on the high end, like where you guys were playing, everything was still top to bottom.
Yeah, and you know, and we started seeing the competitors come out, you know, Sun Microsystems, Apollo Computer, which eventually got absorbed into HP, and it was ripe for the picking, and so it was great. And then eventually, of course, you know, it was VMS, and then hey, let's put Unix on this too. So Ultrix 32, which was developed for the VAX, which was the BSD stuff for VAX was put in, and we made workstations that had either VMS or Ultrix on them. And the Ultrix guys used, at the time it was X10, right?
Right.
Before
X11, that's good.
Before X11. And it was interesting because X10 was actually in their kernel, so it ran really fast. Ooh. And, you know, for a small desktop, it really did some really kick-ass performance compared to the VAX model, the VMS model. I'm sorry,
it's cool. I'd never heard of a system that had X, like an X server built into the actual kernel.
Yeah, it was like a first and the last.
Yeah.
Because when X11 came along, there was a new.
They split it into client server side stuff, right?
Well, it was still client-server, but X11 brought this whole new capabilities. And what there was a corporate directive to basically say, everybody's going to run DEC, you know, what they became DEC Windows, which was basically X11 with Motif on top of it.
Right.
And so
Motif. We got to find a screenshot of Motif for the link.
I'll do that.
Oh, yeah.
It's a classic. So, that's what Unix looked like forever, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And of course, at the time, you know, it was really funny because I remember I had an Apple Lisa in the office area. The only program we had was PERT for doing PERT charts, and we just loved that. And so we're like, we got to do that. And it's kind of hard to do that with X11 and Motif, but it was a little bit more complicated per se. But it was fun. It was a fun time because we got to build these really awesome machines,
right?
And then during that time, there was a small group of people in the Hudson facility, which was the semiconductor group, and a bunch of people out in Seattle that were working on the next generation processor. And that processor architecture was called Prism. Mm-hmm. And it was a 32-bit RISC processor. And they were developing an operating system for it out in Seattle also for it. Two operating systems. It was a Unix flavor and an operating system that had personality. So it would have a VMS personality, or you could make whatever personality you wanted for it.
Was it microkernel based?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And that team of people was led by Dave Cutler, who was one of the original co-architects of VAX VMS.
So let me just pause for two seconds here. I kind of want to explain. So a personality in terms of the operating system is basically the higher level APIs that you'd use. So for the Unix stuff, it'd be like open, close, like the file handling stuff.
Right, POSIX, you know.
POSIX, exactly. That's right. Personality.
Right.
And the stuff that implements it under the hood is sort of the microkernel.
Exactly.
So for the Mac, it's mock.
Right.
And they've got the BSD personality. It's all bolted in there. So what you're talking about is an operating system that I believe VMS is what you're going to end up with. That's got like a microkernel and two distinct personalities, right?
Right. It would have multiple personalities. I think you'll see this connection as I move a little bit further here. But it was basically, so you could run, you know, one of the things that DEC was really good at when they moved from PDP-11 to VAX was providing an application migration environment. Mm-hmm. Apple's done that too with you know, like Rosetta was a perfect example, or running System 9 on OS 10, right? That type of thing. So DEC wanted to do that too. So if they were moving to a RISC processor, they didn't want to, you know, piss off everybody. So they would try to provide an application environment. I think the VMS personality wasn't supposed to be the main thing. It was more of a migration type thing.
Yeah. And this is again, like your customers, this isn't like you buy a computer in the last 2 years, you had support contracts that would last.
Right. Forever.
Years and years. Giant customers. Like, this was high end hardware.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Around the 1998 timeframe, and like I wasn't directly involved with this, but I saw all the side effects of it because it changed what we were doing on the East Coast. There was a battle within the company. The VP of engineering had left the company by this time. His name was Gordon Bell. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he's probably the smartest guy I've ever met in my life. I mean, the guy can hold 4 different conversations simultaneously and not miss a beat. The guy was just totally multitasker. The guy was amazing.
Yeah, huge name in the industry.
Yeah. And so when he left, I think the soul went away from the company. And they put a manufacturing guy in charge of engineering. And so things started to change. So there was this build versus buy mentality. And I guess what it turned out to be is that the MIPS – from, you know, MIPS technologies, the MIPS chip became the chip that everybody wanted to go for within the company. Right. And so basically they canceled Prism and the operating systems around it. And so a core set of people left DEC West, which was the Seattle office, and they ended up at Microsoft.
Right. This is Dave Cutler and his gang.
Yeah, and his gang. And so they started writing Windows NT over there, and which is, you know, so different today than it was back then. I mean,
right.
You know, it was, I guess you could say the same thing about OS 10, you know, when OS, you remember when OS 10 server came out, how different it was than we look at Mavericks today.
Oh, yeah. Night and day. Night and day. Well, they changed up the BSD layer even.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's just totally different.
So
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. So I was going to say, so anyways, that happened. And so we moved to this very risk-oriented thing. We still did VAXs, but the risk machines were becoming more popular because they had more power and there were more bang for the buck. How we beat it in the VAX world is we did some intelligent things in the hardware, like interleave the graphics in with the memory controller so that, you know, you're not using bus cycles, right? You're basically every available memory cycle you have that's not going to memory, you're using it with the graphics subsystem. You know, keeping copies of the cache tags in the IO subsystem, so when a DMA happened, to keep the CPU off the bus, you would look up and say, is this cached? Okay. No? Okay, then don't send an invalidate up to the CPU.
That's clever.
Yeah, there was a machine called the VaxStation VLC 4000 VLC. It was a pizza box. It was about an inch and a half high, and it's about like 12 by 12. And it seriously could kick, graphics wise, it could kick the butt of any RISC machine out there that was running, except for the high end ones. But
sure.
The ones that DEC built, it was better in graphics. Now, CPU-wise, you know, in scalar integer performance, no, not as good. But graphics-wise, it was really powerful. So,
right. But that's clever. It's almost It's not like a GPU, but it is in as much as it tries to move some of the processing of the graphics away from the CPU.
Right.
And sort of like short circuit a lot of decisions that the CPU may have to make. It right. sort of pushes them out to the extremities so that the CPU can be doing other stuff, if I understand correctly.
Yeah. Right. And the one thing that this thing could do, it could draw PIX maps to virtual memory directly because it knew about the VAX page tables. So instead of like drawing to the screen, then bringing it back into backing store, right? You could just
That's pretty cool.
You could draw it right to the PIX maps and then tell the blitter, say, hey, put this rectangle up on the screen. It's boom, and it would do it. So it was pretty cool.
That's a neat trick that would be pretty handy today.
Yeah. And I don't know what Intel is doing in that sort of stuff, but I know a lot of those guys who worked on that now work at Intel in the graphics area. So I wouldn't be surprised that some of that stuff happens there. But moving on. So it came to the realization that 64-bit computing was going to be the big thing, and the question came up again: was
do you have a time frame for this?
This actually was the late 80s.
Okay,
that this came about being. Yeah. So they came up with this product within the company. It was called EVAX originally, right? The extended VAX, and VAX actually was an extension to the PDP-11. And so they're saying this is just extending VAX, but it was really a RISC processor, mm-hmm. and but it was 64 bits. And one of the architects of it, and I'm leaving names out of this, said, I want to build a Cray on a chip. And that's what he wanted to build. And that's essentially what they were trying to build, was a Cray on a chip. Not with the Cray instructions, but that type of superscalar kind of architecture. Yeah.
Do people know, I don't know if the kids out there know what a Cray looks like, but it looks badass. And it was like incredibly powerful. It was like the... sort of the touchstone for, like, if you wanted to invoke some kind of powerful computer, you'd have a Cray.
Yeah, they were gorgeous to look at. Just the seat around the power
supply. I know, it literally had a seat around it. What's the movie? Sneakers.
Sneakers, yes.
If you want to see an awesome shot of a Cray, go watch Sneakers.
Yeah, yeah, that was a perfect – yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
So, so they came up with Alpha. And Alpha, the only – there was very similarities, to most RISC process. But the one thing about Alpha that they really said was they weren't going to put byte and word instructions in because that would slow it down, mm-hmm. right? Which later caused issues. So when they were developing the first three machines, they tried to do various and different ways to do I/O. Right. So you couldn't just do this. I'm going to go talk to a register. Some used mailboxes, some used different types of IO sections, different ways of doing IO. Okay. And all of them were different, which made the hardware abstraction layer within VMS interesting. And they were going to port VMS over to it. And that was an interesting project because VAX VMS was written in assembler. And you have this RISC processor now. So how do you make it work? They wrote a compiler that would compile VAX assembler into Alpha. That's essentially what they did.
I was about to say that's crazy, but it's kind of not that crazy when you think about it, because the complex instruction set system that is used by Intel and at the time, the VAX chips, right?
Yeah.
You can sort of... break that down into simpler instructions. And in fact, internally, Intel does that today. Like, you send it a CISC instruction and it breaks it down into what's called microcode.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly how the x86-64 today works. Yeah. So, there was a big effort in the company and to ship VMS. At this point in time, they called it Open VMS, I guess, was what they changed it to. Okay. And around that time, I was recruited to come out to Seattle to work on a secret project, which was to put NT onto the Alpha.
Okay.
Which was an interesting, and it was a small group of people, about 8 or 9 people who came out, recruited from different parts of the company. To do this. And, some people came from the Unix land, some people came from VMS, some people came from database land, and just they all wanted to get the cream of the crop out there to do this.
Did you have a particular expertise, or were you just like Colonel?
I was mostly Colonel IO person. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was my specialty. So when I got out here, I ended up owning the HAL, you know, the hardware abstraction layer, and which
it's a pretty big.
Well,
that's the piece you don't want to be left holding when you're switching to a new chip and architecture.
Right. And so what happened was they thought of the first device we're going to put this on, and it was called the I think the commercial name was called the AXP150 Alpha, and that had an ESA bus on it.
Yeah.
Now this
ESA,
is where
the EISA or ISA?
Yeah. EISA. Right? Yeah. So
it's a 32-bit extension to a 16-bit bus, right?
Yeah.
PC used to use them.
Right, with a processor that didn't have byte and word instructions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you can see the conundrum we were under.
I don't even know how you do that. You'd need some special hardware to mask stuff off or something, wouldn't you?
Well, that's the thing, is that this was sort of like a concert with one of the designers, the hardware designers back east, who understood the plight. And he was – I think he works at Apple today as one of their hardware designers, but he's like another one of the smartest guys I've ever met. Mm-hmm. He can't drive a car because his mind is always going, and he doesn't, you know, on computer stuff, but he's an absolute genius. And, so what we ended up doing was, you could actually to read a byte or write a byte on the bus. You would actually have to set a byte lane and a mask and do the access, right?
Yeah,
on
that
it.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So the problem with that was, you know, IO is mapped in page tables.
Right.
And there's not enough page tables in the system to map all that IO, because each byte essentially was 128 bytes away from each other on the bus in a sparse address space. Oh. So there was a mode in Alpha that was really cool. It was a fixed TLB, a translation buffer entry, and it was 64 bits. And we could use it to basically map all of IO with one translation buffer entry. The downside, it was 64 bits, and we were on a 32-bit operating system. So I came up with this thing called the address swizzler. And basically what it was we know bits 48 through 63 are always one. Okay, yeah. That's a constant. And we know that if we shift down the remaining address 7 bits to the right, we now have a pointer that fits in 30 bits, right?
Yeah.
And we still have another 2 bits there to play with to tell us whether in ESA IO space or ESA memory space.
Yeah,
so you've got
an embarrassment of riches.
Yes. So those
top 2 bits would select what IO space you were going to talk to.
Exactly. And you could do pointer arithmetic on it, which was interesting. So it was convincing Dave and his team to create these access macros. And anybody who does device driver development to this day knows that these access macros inside of NT called read register u care, read register long, read register word, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then you would do your access through that. So essentially you would give it the pointer and it would return back the datum, or if you were writing something, you give it the pointer and the datum and it would write it.
It would take your pointer and like do your magic swizzle thing to turn it into
On Intel, I would just simply issue an in-out instruction, right?
Sure. Yeah.
On MIPS, it would just simply do a memory register assignment, right, or whatever. And on Alpha, it would be this unrolled loop of assembler code that would actually go do the address swizzling and byte lane shifting to get the byte back in the right place. And it was very highly optimized. It took weeks and weeks of hand assembling that to make sure that, you know, you weren't draining the pipe, you weren't blocking, you weren't branching incorrectly and that sort of stuff. And that's how we got it to work.
Yeah. This is for IO too, which is not like IO gets touched all the time, especially if you're considering paging and anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so the worst part was like the first Ethernet controller we had 128K buffer on it. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, we're not just going to, for every bike, go through this whole address swizzle just to go get a bite every time if I want to move the whole, you know, 32K out. So actually, we created an extension to those macros, and it was read register ucare buffer. I think it was, and write register ucare buffer, which basically says, here's a pointer length. It was like
pointer into length, like a range kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, as we used to call in the VAX, the move C3 instruction, which, you know, basically was a character instruction that just said, give me these many bytes at this address. So, and so we did that, and that ended up working. And, the problem was with that fixed TLB entry is that you never knew if you were violating anything. So we had the debug builds. Alpha has this mode, a privilege mode called PAL mode. And PAL mode is amazing because you can create instructions in it on the fly. You can do a bunch of stuff. The cost is that you would drain the pipe doing it. So in a debug environment, we just said, well, we'll instrument the PAL code to basically say, we'll do a soft TLB on this thing. So we'll trap anybody who's not conforming, right? But on the production, it's running with the blade goes disengaged. So.
Wow. Okay. So wait, let me just figure this out for a bit. You can make your own instructions by what? Like you issue an opcode to the CPU, you fault, and then you can handle that fault and decode the way that you want?
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's kind of costly. Crazy, but
pretty cool.
It was costly because you basically you would drain the pipe every time you entered PAL mode.
Yeah.
So
do the caches retain?
You probably cause cache issues too.
Yeah.
Depending on where it is, but it was something that was great to have in the war chest, but you tried not to. I mean, basically,
seems great for debugging for sure.
Right, right. Yeah. And we used PAL mode to set up the address space to look basically like a MIPS, right? So that it was easier to port the code, right?
Right.
So because it's a 64-bit machine, but we want to have a 32-bit address space. Right.
That's pretty cool. Wait, and so could you breakpoint anything by just take an opcode and flip like a high bit, and it'll throw an exception, and you can handle it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool. That is cool. One thing I will always say about DEC engineers, they were some of the smartest SOBs I've ever met in my life. These guys lived architecture, and they knew how to get, you know, the most out of something. And they, you know, and the guys who understood software really provided a lot of stuff in the hardware to help that out. The guys who didn't understand software well, we won't go into those.
I always heard a lot of great things about Alpha.
Yes.
But I mean, I never had one in my hands because they were, you know, pretty expensive and kind of.
We had like five of them at my old job when we did, you know, analytical databases. That was their development platform of choice. And I just remember those rows of giant machines.
Cool. Oh, you had the big ones.
Yeah, that big Indian, little Indian ones. They were fantastic. Yeah.
It was an amazing architecture, you know, superscalar, you know, pipelined out the butt, 200 megahertz for the, what was called the EV4. And, you know, in a time when the Pentium hadn't even really come out yet, and the first one was at 60 megahertz, right. This thing could execute an instruction every 5 nanoseconds. And it was, you know, a lot of people said, well, yeah, but add two unaligned words, you know, or, you know, 16-bit entities, you have to mass shift and all that.
Pick some pathological case for it, and it's like, of course it falls over.
But actually, it did those things really fast.
Oh, did it even? Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And later on, this was post after I left DEC, but there was an ECO done to the system, what they call it, systems reference manual. And the architecture, I think it was in the EV5-6, they actually added back the byte and word instructions, because the reason I always was told they left them out was they couldn't do a load shift in one clock cycle. But there was this engineer in the Hudson facility said, oh, I can do that. And they just proved it, and they ended up putting it back in. So later versions of Alpha NT didn't have all that bit swizzling in it because it had byte and word instructions back.
That's cool. So wait, I guess I should explain that. So Intel and all those other chips, complex instruction set computer chips, basically, they have various opcodes that tell the chip to go do what to do. And they can take a variable number of clock cycles.
Right.
So like on an Intel, I can't remember the actual measurements, but let's say you're moving between registers, that's one clock cycle. If you're moving from memory into register, that's X clock cycles.
Well, if you do them on an unaligned boundary.
If you do, yeah. There's a bunch of – there's any number of things that screw up clock cycles or that cost clock cycles. But on a RISC chip, which is what the Alpha was – and the MIPS and ARM and PowerPC, others, yeah.
ARM, yeah.
Everything was meant to take exactly one clock cycle. And if you couldn't do it in one clock cycle, it wasn't going in the instruction set. That's sort of the philosophical
cutoff point
between the two of them, right?
Right. Yeah. And the point was, I think what a lot of people don't also forget that the RISC machines are fixed length instructions. So instruction prediction was easier than like Intel or VAX, which had variable length instructions. And so, you know, the prediction logic is very hard to come in. Is that a move instruction? Is that a branch instruction? Is that, you know, it's very hard to do that when you're coming in with variable length instructions. With a fixed length, you can predict them pretty easily.
Yeah. And one of the arguments against RISC at the time was that your code would be significantly larger.
Yes.
Because you not only could CISC instructions be longer to decode, but they could also be shorter in many cases, right? Like I think the Intel even has some string operations that like
– Well, yeah, yeah.
Is that true? Like they expect a zero terminated, a null terminated string, right?
Yeah, VAX had the same thing. The MOVEC5 instruction was a five operand instruction that gave you source, destination, size, and zero termination. You
that's
know.
Like string and copy, like built
exactly.
Right into
yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You try to do that on an alpha. Oh, you could do that in probably, I don't know, 20 instructions, and they were still faster than a VAX. So,
so it was one of the first highly pipelined computers too.
Yeah, yeah, it was very highly pipelined.
And were you working in assembler at this point, or you had a
Combination of C and assembler? Okay. On the NT project on VMS, that was a different story. We didn't have a C compiler at the time, so we wrote everything in a language called Bliss, which is Bill's language for implementing system software out of Carnegie Mellon.
That is old school computer nerdery, and I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so that was the other thing about this whole project on NT, we needed a compiler, and Microsoft C was still in development for the NT 32-bit stuff and the MIPS. So we actually took, I don't know if you remember what OSF, I remember OSF, but that was the
open system firmware.
No, OSF was Open Systems Foundation. They had a Unix. That ran on Alpha.
Sorry, I'm getting screwed up. Okay, yeah.
So we borrowed their 64-bit compiler and we put a 32-bit address mode in it, right? So we could actually compile. And everybody says, well, that's great. And we had this great guy who worked for us who was just – I still hang with him nowadays. He's one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. And he made this compiler sing. It was amazing. And people said, well – but we got C++ too. So, yeah, well, so we used a tool that everybody hates but ends up using. It's called CFront, which would translate your C++ into C. So the first version of Alpha NT, which was 3.1, was built on this compiler with CFront doing all the C++. And that was just one piece. The other piece is the memory management page size for Alpha was 8K, whereas Intel and MIPS and PowerPC, they were 4K size. And
you know what's great? So it hasn't aired yet, but the previous episode we just discussed, we just recorded, I was talking to Mike Ash.
Yeah.
And we were laughing about like, hey, do you even know any page sizes that aren't 4K?
Yeah, exactly.
And Alpha. Turns out, yeah.
and it was
crazy, 8K, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we always remembered the constant pound 2000, or 8000, 8192 if you wanted, but which we found a number of issues inside NT because of that.
I bet.
Some assumptions that pages are 4K.
Yeah,
and also another thing some assumptions you would find was NT was a 32-bit operating system, so. Nobody would do this nowadays, but back in, this is 20-something years ago, people would sometimes try to optimize by saying, hey, I'm passing through this function these these pointers and they happen to be in the same struct, why don't I just pass one pointer and then I'll just add, you know, plus four. And oh, I'll get to the next element in the array, right? No, not on a 64-bit, because it is all ones and you access that and you crash. Oh, yeah. So there were some assumptions on var_args too that were broken. And so these little things that, you know, this is anytime you make an
var_args
architectural
are gonna
port.
Break though. That
yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. And I think the greatest story I ever heard about Alpha, and this was a guy who worked with us, he was like the epitome of computer science guy. Was one of the smartest guys. He was doing the floating point unwinder for floating point exceptions. And he said that and alpha was defined as all instructions of exceptions are imprecise. So you had no idea when they were going to come in. If you had a NAND, 36 instructions later, all of a sudden you get signal, hey, there was a NAND somewhere up the stream, and you would fault, and you had to unwind to find it.
Which is a sort of a byproduct of the way of the massive pipelining.
Exactly. Yeah. But it did those 36 instructions really fast.
Right.
And that was the only thing everybody said, well, it takes this many instructions, but they do them really fast.
Yeah.
And that was a beautiful processor. I'm seriously, it was a beautiful architecture, you know, and of course, you know, having spent many a year at DEC, it was, you know, you were kind of partial to it because you grew up in that family, but you know, it's like a lot of those guys left and they went off and formed other companies like PA Semi, for example. One of the guys.
That's what they do at Apple like now, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's another guy who was actually involved on the Prism architecture, the previous one. And he left and worked on the Power architecture at, I think he was at Apple when he worked on it. And then he left and came back to DEC and worked on the Strongarm.
Nice.
And then those guys split up when Intel bought it. And like I said, PA Semi created another company called Alchemy was created out of that. And they did a super fast MIPS processor that AMD eventually bought. And those guys, they all float around today. And they're like the super chip guys. I don't think there's anybody like them. They're just amazing. I mean, these guys talk polygons, you know, moving the polygons in a way to get the best performance on the chip die. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I don't. I'm like, that's above my pay grade.
Well, DEC was a real powerhouse and titan for many, many years. And it's kind of, I don't know if I'd say that. Maybe it's ironic. It's kind of sad that sort of NT itself and the Intel architecture ended up undermining DEC and, you know, eventually Sun and even HP on the high end. Did you get a sense of that as you were working there? Or like,
One of the things that I thought was the biggest problem was the support within the company itself for NT, right? It wasn't, you know, it's sort of like, I think Microsoft is actually going through that with this now, the cash cow, VMS was the cash cow.
Yeah.
And do nothing that's going to take money away from the cash cow. And we saw that. We actually saw that back in the early 80s with an operating system within DEC called VAX ELN, which was a real-time operating system that was done out in Seattle, originally for the MicroVAX one. They made them brain dead the address space so that you couldn't run VMS programs on it. And
what was that in the service of being real-time, or was that just because?
Yeah, just two things. Because, you know, protect the cash cow. And you saw that at Microsoft, too, when Windows CE came out. The reason that Windows CE wasn't successful because it was brain dead, because they didn't want to take away from the desktop. You know, they wanted to have Windows everywhere, but, hey, listen, we don't want to run, you know, Excel on a Windows CE device, right? So brain dead the address space so they can't do it. Now, that's my opinion. Doesn't mean it's fact, but I just want to make that disclosure because I'm sure somebody will come up, oh, he's wrong. But, you know, you see that today with Microsoft again, the Windows Everywhere strategy. You know, they're like, you know, we're not going to do anything. We're not going to embrace the iPad. It's going to eat into us. You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, I don't know if that's a fatal blow to companies. One of the things that I appreciate the most about Apple is that they're not afraid to eat their young. And sometimes that's painful for us guys as developers, but
they actively hunt them in the wilderness.
I know, but you know, in the long run, I think it's the right thing. But back to the deck NT thing, it was, they didn't really support it because it was behind, it was VMS, right. Was the cash cow. And so sort of, you know, everybody was being supported, you know, the Seattle group got pretty big by that time, but they felt like they were the second class citizens. One of the good things that came out of all that was there was a bunch of guys back east who, got together with some guys out of the Seattle office and created clustering for NT. And that eventually ended up over in Microsoft, right? Because a lot of those guys ended up over there. So that's where all that clustering stuff came from.
I didn't know that came from outside. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. That was – and, you know, I mean, NT in and of itself, you know, like, you know, Azure runs it, you know, and it's great. You know, I think what happened over the years, this is just, you know, the frameworks, there's too many frameworks, they add to it and it just bloats it down.
Right.
And one of the things that, you know, and that's the other thing, you know, we look at, you know, OS 10 today and we see the framework's been around since the 80s. Right.
Yep.
And, you know, of course it's constantly improved, but if you
look there's still stuff in AppKit, it's like.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy to look at times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you look at Microsoft. They went through the MFC period, the ATL period, and it was .NET 1, .NET 2, .NET 3. What are they on now? I don't know what they're on now.
ATL, one, I always forget about that one. That one is brutal.
Yeah, exactly. Active Template Library.
Yeah.
So it was always the framework changed all the time, and so there's no really good time to stabilize it. Whereas, you know, what has become Cocoa has been matured over a number of 20-something years. So, you know.
No, and it still works. It's still great. I chuckle every now and then when I see, like, NS Window or something, and it's like, wants color display.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I think that's probably just returning yes forever. But, you know, it's aged remarkably well given, you know, given all the hardware changes it's been through.
Yeah, no, and it's just a blast to code in.
So how would you contrast or compare sort of a NT kernel to Darwin, which, you know, which is basically the OS X and iOS kernel?
Well, the NT kernel back when it was created was there was a kernel and then there's the executive that surrounds it. Right. And the kernel in and of itself, its scheduling entity is a thread. Right. That's it. Right. And the executive is what defines the process, the address space and everything. The kernel itself was pretty rock solid. And that's what mock was too. Also, right. Remember mock was it scheduling entity was a thread. And, that was the competition, I think, was between Ricky Rashid and Cutler, who's building the best kernel at that time, you know. And it's funny how Ricky ended up at Microsoft. I think all those guys who worked on that kernel, which was really, you know, I still love the 90s version of NT.
Right.
It's you got people in there now, I think, that are just throw the whole kitchen sink into it. You know, just do this. The things they would have to do to like to support ATL and things like that were just.
Now, would that land down in the kernel?
Yeah, because you would have to like, you're over the Great Wall of China down into the kernel layer when you walk in the object lists and things like that. So MFC used to walk the object list, and what ATL did itself.
MFC touched when had needed kernels.
Well, no. Okay. There was kernels. Remember, there's a mapping of objects. Right. The kernel itself is not object oriented, but there are C objects. And if you want to believe what an object is,
sure.
Basically they're structs that are made to look like objects, so that when you talk between the kernel and the user layer, that you they're the what I want to call it the translation is. Pretty easy between the two. No, I shouldn't say that the MFC object layer was in the kernel itself, but it was, you know, it was above the NT APIs.
Sure.
Right? There's Win32. It's below Win32, obviously, right?
Right.
And then there's these other APIs. There's private APIs called NT API, and then it was just in that area there.
Oh, okay. So it start messing with it. Yeah, right. Well, right. Basically, it would infect the personality.
Yeah, because it was the object lookup. You had to walk the list.
Right.
You know, and so it's like, I got to get this object. So in ATL, they try to solve that by doing, when you would load the object, you would modify the pointer, or the vector pointing to it, so you could just look into the table and find it.
Right? Oh, that's kind of bananas.
Yeah, this means you have to say, oh, invalidate this translation because we just modified the pointer. But it was very fast lookup at that point, you know. And I don't know how they did anything after that when the CLR came along or any of that. By that time I had moved on.
CLR seems like, I mean, ideally it would not do any of that kind of garbage because it would sit atop everything, right? So
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a VM, right? So it's like all.
Yeah. Well, one hopes.
I worked on an OS where the VM was part of the kernel.
So that's kind of interesting. Which OS was that, if you can say?
It was an operating system called Savage OS.
Huh, okay.
You ever heard Savage? A bunch of guys from Bell Labs started that company. They were on the Inferno operating system, and they wanted to build a job.
Yeah.
Okay. Java operating system.
Yeah, Inferno is super interesting. Yeah.
Right. So basically they wanted to build a Java operating system. The only API is Java, right? But they understood that, you know, most Java implementations, you're 16 layers above the hardware.
Right.
And so what they did was there was a thing, I guess they call them JNI now, but back in the old days, they would call a thing called the NMI interface, where it's native method interface.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so what they did is about 88% of the classes, they just thunked into a native mode and executed them. So basically nothing went through the bytecode interpreter, right? So
that's kind of
– Yeah. The graphics – they had on the other side of AWT, they had this, we had this thing called CWT, the C window toolkit. Mm-hmm. And so when you call an AWT call, it would immediately pass that through the NMI into the C toolkit, and it would all happen in the native operating system. So it would run on the native execution unit. And what was also interesting is we modeled the OS threads after Java threads, so we didn't have to discern between scheduling whether this was a Java thread or an OS thread. They were both the same. They used the same.
That's kind of cool. I mean, it's basically making concrete what the Java virtual machine is.
Yeah.
It's like, well, let's just go build that machine.
And then we also had the JVM for those things that we didn't abstract, right? So, but we had it sitting as a service of the kernel. So if you look at a Java application running on the OS, it was the JVM, you had the system class loader, user class loader, and then the user program. Mm-hmm. And that was an address space, and we called that a JPROC or a JPROCESS.
Okay.
And so you could have n number of those, unlike JVMs that ran on other like embedded systems, right. You only could run one Java app. Well, you could run n number of those, as much as memory you had. So on the – remember the compact IPAC? On the 200 megahertz strong arm that was in the compact IPAC, we ran Java – on that better than most 90 megahertz I was probably 100 megahertz at the time desktops.
So, wow.
And the thing was, is the system class loader was a shareable class loader, right? So
yeah, it's going to be like a, you know, frameworks get shared between apps and everything, right? Yeah.
Right. So we ref counted it, right? So, you want to use that class. There's a ref count against it. When you're done with it, the garbage collector wouldn't take it away. We would just decrement the ref count until nobody was using it anymore. Then we'd sweep it. So.
And I mean, I guess anything that was implemented by, I don't want to say thunking, but basically dropping down to the C layer, you just wouldn't bother reaping that at all, right?
Right. Like when we implemented JSR 1, was it 126 or was it – I'm trying to – I think I'm so confused. It was the multimedia one. We basically just create a pipe down to the C layer, right, for media streaming and things like that. So it was a cool operating system. We accelerated AWT and the graphics subsystem. Really smart guy, Frank Barris, who he was a graduate of RIT. He would get his head in that, and he was just totally accelerated. And you could take like a J2SE application that ran on the desktop and run it on this thing. Now, of course, the screen's not the same size, but sure. It would just run. And I was like, wow, that was impressive. So that was a cool operating system.
Was that meant to be a commercial?
Yes.
Or was it like an academic? Okay.
What happened was we raised a lot of money from the European carriers. And unfortunately, you know, they change management when you raise a lot of money. And the rest, you know, I won't comment on the rest. But basically, if you look at what Android is today, a lot of its roots came out of the ideas that came out of there, out of Savage.
Yeah, it sounds like a similar idea.
In fact, I remember we went to Danger to pitch Andy Rubin on it originally. And when Savage ended up going away, one of the guys who was on our board ended up co-founding Android with Andy before Google bought them.
Explains it. I mean, take all the good data you can, right?
Yeah, I don't think they basically, you know.
No, I'm not saying they nicked anything, but I mean,
it was an interesting idea.
Becoming NT kind of does the same thing, right? Like, takes a lot of the similar ideas of VMS and brings them over to NT at Microsoft.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing is that there's a lot of people say, well, you stole this. Well, no, it's a common idea, right? I mean, if you say, well, you can't use your TLBs that way, well, that's like common computer science stuff. I mean, you can't patent that and protect that. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to veer into patents and just start raging. But
oh, no, please don't.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you create something in one place and then you understand that technique, and then in the next place you work, you reuse the same technique. It's like that's what learning is. That's why people hire me. That's my value, right? It's like that I'm not the idiot I started out with when I started playing.
It's called intellectual capital. You know, right. That's intellectual capital. You know, I mean, if we all at one point in time in our careers were prevented from working on anything that we had worked on before, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Exactly.
You know? Exactly. So,
so one of the things I loved about NT when it came so I was an OS2 guy at the time.
Oh, yeah. I
liked the workplace shell. And
did you know that NT was originally called NTOS2?
I did, actually. That's where I'm going with this. Yeah.
Yeah.
because they basically wanted to kind of take over whatever. IBM and Microsoft had a love hate / stab you in the back kind of.
That was a nasty divorce.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
No one thought about the kids.
Yeah. Well.
Well, they did. They both, you know, Microsoft took the kids and sort of shivved IBM into the back. But OS 2 was interesting. More so to me. I mean, so I came from DOS, Windows 3.1 at the time. Like Windows pre-NT just did not interest me at all.
Well, Windows 3.0
made me mad. Yeah.
Windows 3.0 was great, and Windows 3.1 fixed it. And
Wait, do you mean NT 3.0?
No, Windows itself.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's when it came about being was when Windows really took off there. It was like, why are we even looking at anything else on here?
Yeah.
You just put this on here and let's build a workstation class Windows environment. Right. And of course, you know, NT originally, this is another folklore. I wasn't around during this period, but I knew a lot of people who worked on it, that it was originally being developed on the i860 processor from Intel. And and it turned out it didn't work. So they ended up moving to the MIPS. And so the MIPS was actually the first implementation they did. And it wasn't until, I think, after the OS2 divorce that the x86 came about being. And so it was actually, it turned out it became the dominant architecture, but it was actually the second one they were working on.
That's interesting. So did they – I can't remember. Did the first Intel version run on the 286 or the 386?
It ran on – It had to run on the 386.
Yeah, because 286 was kind of
drained. They broke the protection mechanism in 286. So
yeah, it was completely screwed up. 386 was pretty good. 286 was kind of nuts.
But 486 was the target, I think, because it had the appropriate things. And you know, on Intel, they actually had this thing called WoW, right? Windows on Windows, so you could run Windows 16 apps on Windows 32 NT. Yeah,
which. I was going to bring up because you used the verb thunking, which I don't know how widely deployed that is anymore, but thunking is basically what they would do to call Windows 16 functions.
Right.
Win 16 APIs from Windows 32 bit apps.
The other way around. It was the other way around. So you would thunk it into Win 32.
Right, that would be it. So the WoW would end up being like you'd be running a 16-bit Windows app, and every time it would try to call into the API, Windows APIs, it would do this thing called thunking, which basically I can't even remember how that worked. It would decode the arguments and
it was magic. It was FM, and then on Alpha, the problem we had was. We wanted to provide that too, right? And so all we had was a 286 emulator, which was okay because most Windows apps didn't take advantage of the protection mechanism in the 386 anyway. So later they could, like Windows 95 era they could, but back in the Windows 3.1 it was just Win 16 segmented architecture, blah blah blah.
Okay.
And so 286 was fine enough. So we actually emulated a 286 on the Alpha. We licensed this stuff from Phoenix Technologies or somebody like that.
Really, they had the BIOS guys basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they also had an emulation thing because we had worked with them on this shows my age on VAX VMS. We were actually working. I worked with them on a 286 coprocessor for one of the VAX workstations provide. Cool. And we actually showed Bill Gates in 87. Windows 1.03 running inside our windowing system.
How did he like that?
He just looked at it and went, why would I want all the other stuff around? I just have Windows. Like, yeah, you got a point. But
those were cool days when you would like stick a coprocessor in that was basically just another computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you could do.
Also, remember those Mac cards that you could get that was basically just stuck a PC inside your Mac?
Yeah.
Thinking of that these days is just bananas.
Here's another interesting tidbit. And these are tidbits, and they're part of folklore per se. I don't know about the accuracies of them. But, well, I do know this. The IBM guys who were out in Kirkland, Washington, helped do the port to the PowerPC for NT. Yeah. And I remember the guy thanking me and the other team for doing the Alpha port because we found all the portable problems. So it actually had an easy job of doing it. And so because of the result of that, they actually could take it down to Cupertino and they actually bootstrapped it on a Mac.
I had heard that actually because they were considering using NT to replace classic OS, classic Mac OS.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, that was that. And I guess that port remained dormant for a long time until Xbox came out, and that's using that port.
Yeah.
So hats off to those guys.
Yeah. So PowerPC, you can switch the Endian. I can't remember. Did NT run it in to match Intel Endian or to match network?
Yeah. It was little Endian, which is Intel Endian.
Yeah.
And so I think what they did on the Macintosh is they actually in the open firmware, they actually had a mode that you could actually swap the Endian for something. I don't know. They could bootstrap the PowerPC in a different mode to get that up and running. But I don't know. It's just the folklores that I've heard throughout the industry. But I left the Alpha NT project around NT 3.351. This is another cool tidbit. Do you know that there was an Alpha notebook that never got sold?
did not know that. I didn't even know you could do that because I thought they ran pretty hot and big.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, they were like a little oven. There was a chip that DEC did called the Low Cost Alpha. And the 20166, I think, was the part denominator. We used to call it LCA for low cost alpha. And it was an integrated alpha, slower CPU, 166 megahertz, with a PCI bus on it and a single chip, but it had its own cooling tower because it dissipated a number of watts. And there was a team back in the East Coast that wanted to build a notebook with alpha in it. And so I actually got put on that project because I understood, you know, the hardware aspects and all that sort of stuff and got to meet with them. And they were having a company out of England build it for them, a company called Tadpole. If you remember, those guys did the Spark notebook. I don't know if you remember the Spark book.
I didn't. Again, I wouldn't have guessed you could have made one of those.
Yeah. Anyways, this product never saw the light of day. Now, the guys at Tadpole always codenamed their projects with poets, right? So you're going to love this. So they call the Alpha Notebook Burns. And apropos, it was really funny because I went to this meeting and they said, well, I said, what's it made out of? And they said, oh, it's magnesium. And I went, what? Magnesium? Oh, no, magnesium alloy. Oh, okay. Jesus. Okay, magnesium. I understand that. And it was... And they would cooling, you know, they had the cooling heat sink thermobonded to the magnesium alloy. Yeah. And it would sit on your lap and it would literally burn your lap. That's so hot. So Burns was so apropos.
Magnesium anywhere near my lap and that much heat is like, that is just
not going to happen.
I thought it was an alloy and it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was inert. Yeah. Yeah.
You seen those videos of Next Cubes burning?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, they go up pretty good. I mean,
they do. Yeah. It's like, I think that was why I said it, because I remember hearing stories about that, back then. So anyways, the point being is that the project we had PCMCA slots, NT didn't have PCMCA. Yeah. Yeah. So I whipped together, I worked with a guy over at Microsoft.
That was proprietary to IBM at some point, right? Maybe I'm crazy.
I don't remember who came up with it and whoever did.
I thought that came up with that PS2 crazy. Yeah. Maybe I'm nuts, though. But anyway.
The way you read the tuples out of this thing were insane, right? They were bit encoded tuples to tell you whether or not. This was all the spec on the PCMCA. And obviously a hardware guy created this because no software guy would ever create something like this. And you read the tuples, what kind of card? Oh, I'm a network card. Okay. Cause we needed to have networking, through a PCMCA card, back then there was no Wi-Fi or anything like that. And, and so I actually wrote static PCMCA. So if a known card went in, we'd identify it and we go, okay, we can configure you to look like an ISA card. Right. And then you could use the ISA driver on it. Okay. We shared that with Microsoft, right? In 3.5.1. And they actually shipped that. And later in life I was working in another company and I was interviewing this guy from Germany who's going to be our general manager over in Germany, this other company. And I said, oh, you worked at Cardsoft. I go, what did you think of the NT PCMCA support in 3.5.1? He goes, oh, that was a piece of shit, right? And I'm sitting there going like, I wrote that. And he went, oh, do I have the job? Yeah, you do. Because you're right. It was a horrible implementation. I'm surprised that Microsoft ever put it in there. And of course, with 4.0, they actually did a real implementation. But
so I was going to ask you about 4.0 because 4.0, things get
weird,
right? Yeah. 4.0 was when I really started paying attention, or I started running NT on my regular thing because OS2 Warp at the time, it was done. But they did something that was kind of counter to my OS nerd fanboy stuff in that they moved the graphics driver out of user land and into kernel space.
Yes, they moved GDI into the kernel.
Yeah.
Oh, sound familiar?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I didn't know that. I thought it was just that. I didn't know that they'd done it with other systems. But how do you feel about that?
I saw that coming. I think that's I don't know if that was the driving reason I left. I was kind of saying, you know, that doesn't seem architecturally pure, but you know,
this is not a reason to not do something in a practical product kind of way. But you know, at the same time,
I'm sure they had their reasons. It was performance reasons, you know, getting across the Great Barrier, as we used to call it, into kernel mode from the drivers back from GDI 32 was an expensive operation, and they wanted to speed that up. It just broke a lot of software when they did that, mostly the multi-screened and the multi-head companies that would have.
Yep.
Like Windows-based terminals or whatever, or maybe it was that didn't exist then. Well, yeah, it was some sort of way you could. Oh, what was it? There was an application like Hummingbird or something that could run.
There was a big one. Display.
Yeah, and so it broke a lot.
Citrix.
That's what. Yeah, and it broke a lot of those things when they did that. But you know, they have their reasons. You know, I mean, we all know that when Apple does certain things, you know, they break. And. And we, you know, and people say, well, you know, it's okay for Apple to do it, but not Microsoft. And no, everybody, if you make architectural decisions that, you know, impact your users, make sure your users are well aware of it. Just don't spring it upon them. And I think Microsoft did a good job of telling people, hey, we're doing this and we're going to break some things. Just be prepared. And it's for the greater good. Now, I don't know if it was for the greater good or not, but, you know, I still used NT until about, I don't know, I think the last version of NT I ran was XP. I haven't run anything since then. So.
Okay. Do you miss it? I mean, did you like the upper layers, or you just liked working on the
I loved the architecture of the kernel. It was
it was
well thought out. It was a great. I my hat's off to those guys who architected that, because it was really. I won't talk about the registry though. That's another.
No, but that's well above the kernel. Well, is it?
Well, no, it was in that layer, right? Because don't get me started.
Well, that was a mistake. But okay, whatever. You get a mistake,
right? And so it was still you know, and it's a really nice, I always thought it was a nice kernel and nice executive. Right. And now
can we describe it for our listeners? Cause, I have a vague understanding of it, but if we can hear you walk through it, it'd be great.
Okay. Well, there was the NTOS kernel itself, right? There's two versions of the kernel. There's the NTOS kernel and the NTOS multiprocessing kernel. And this was now, remember, this is 4.0 and behind, right? Because I don't know what they do today. They would have, burden single processors with all the multiprocessor overhead. So they had two kernels that they would decide to load, on the RISC machines. It was OS loader that the firmwares would load, and they would load the appropriate kernel based on the architecture. On the x86, the BIOS would load this thing called NT Loader, which would set up the environment to get into you know, the virtual mode.
They'd take ring zero and set everything up. And
yeah, exactly. So if you're a single processor, you didn't incur all the multiprocessing overhead, so you would load NTOS kernel. And then if you were a multiprocessor, you would load NT MP kernel or something like that. And so the kernel itself was this little piece of code that basically its whole goal in life was just to schedule threads, right? And then there was the executive, and that's the thing that basically controlled all the APIs in.
Right.
And then
that's
there was
the executive that hosts the personalities, right?
Right. And then there's well, they have subsystems, okay? So NT actually had two subsystems. It had the Windows subsystem, and it also had a POSIX one. So you could actually – there was a guy, I forget his name, but he wrote a TC shell for NT using the POSIX subsystem. And it was great having a C shell on NT, because that NT shell was kind of weird. Cool.
Yeah. Because I think they shipped that for a while as Microsoft Unix pack or some –
yeah, there was some.
You could pay them some money, and they would give you some Unix-y stuff.
Yeah, you could do that. But then of course you had the memory manager that would take care of all memory management. And I'm trying to remember it all off the top of my head now.
Now that was again in kernel space, right?
Yeah, that was all in kernel space. And then there was this thing called NTAPI, and that was the APIs into that layer, right? Win32 sat on top of that, right? So you could. There was also this API called Zwappy, right? And Zwappy was a reverse way so the kernel could call up into the Win32 layer, right? But it was hardly ever used, right? But it was there so you could do a reverse call up.
It almost seems like it shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
It was good. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good to have in case you really need it, but you don't really want to be architecting your thing.
The other thing about NT was it had very similar things to VMS, and it solved a lot of problems that VMS had. VMS, I think version 6 and before, never had kernel threads, right? Okay. So it was all just process. And NT always had kernel threads because they realized that was a bad thing on VMS.
Do you mean a threaded kernel or a kernel that can manage user-side threads?
User-side threads, yes.
Okay.
And a multi-threaded kernel, right?
Yeah, because the multi-threaded kernel, even like OS 10 didn't get till, I don't know, I want to say 10.2, 10.3.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And then they had a giant lock. Like, anyway, yeah.
Oh, don't give me the locks yet.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anyways,
so what would happen is so they had a couple of things. They had deferred procedure calls, and you had asynchronous procedure calls. Mm-hmm. And deferred procedure calls is you would get an interrupt from the hardware device, and you get enough information off the hardware device, and you want to defer the processing at a lower URCL so that you didn't lock up the system, right? Mm-hmm. So you would schedule this thread, this deferred procedure call thread, and then when URCL dropped to a certain level, all of a sudden here's a queue of things to start executing for processing I/O.
Do you get an interrupt when the URCL changes? How do you know, or do you just poll it every time? Like you
don't know, because what happens, the way the system works is very much like VMS did. Interrupts come at this certain layer,
yeah,
and then when there's no more interrupts, it drops down. It starts lowering URCL to different steps, and certain things happen at certain URCLs, right? So the IO work, it would drop to, what was it, IO 3?
Okay, so it literally, the kernel itself, it's getting interrupts, and it's not. And then so it's like, well, I've got nothing to do, so now I'm going to go take care of these things.
Right, I'm going to go take care of these things, right? Yeah. So then it would start processing those threads, and it would manage those threads. VMS never had that. You would get an interrupt, and you had two registers to save your context. Right. And you had the unit control block, and that's all you had. You didn't have a stack. You didn't have nothing. And so they solved a lot of that problem in here. You had the stack, you know, you could go do things with. But they also had this thing called an asynchronous procedure call, which was sort of a holdover from VMS. VMS called them asynchronous traps. And essentially an AST was a way to tell a process, you got to execute this code. Mm-hmm. Right. And I always thought that was. I think I've only used them once, but they were there. I don't think I ever used them in NT, but
It would just do it at some point, like never.
Yeah. Yeah. I would schedule it, but it was like, I know in VMS,
I guess maybe outbound IO maybe.
You could just say like, I remember, what would happen is like in VMS, and this is like blurring my mind, but you could do an asynchronous would trap. An asynchronous trap would go out when the terminal driver detected something coming in and needed to create a process. And so you would send an asynchronous trap to say, I need to create a process and tie it to this terminal. I don't know if NT used them or not, but they were there.
Yeah.
but they would call asynchronous procedure. Yeah,
that seems like somebody's cute idea that made it out of the lab and into a product and then just kind of sits there for a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Doesn't seem that useful though.
But it was really nice. But they had the same classic problem that for multi-processing that VMS had, mm-hmm. and it was that everything was locking. In NT, it was called IO lock 8. Everything would coalesce around IO lock 8 because if you're going to go do IO stuff, you have to take out the lock, right?
Right.
And so only one processor could have the lock, right?
Yep.
So you're, you know, everybody's sitting there spinning their wheels waiting for the IO to unlock. And then, okay, now it's unlocked. Okay, now, oh, somebody else got the lock, you know, and you would sit there and spin. So,
Implementing this stuff is incredibly tough because You're saying IO, like somebody's thinking like, oh, well, when, you know, the user presses file save, it's like, no, there is IO going on constantly and swapping and like, oh, God knows what else, you know, network traffic.
Well, network traffic, even your mouse movement.
I was just about to say, flip out on your mouse and just.
Yeah. Right. The refresh timer in the display, because you had 60 hertz, you know, refresh time in the old days. So that interrupt would happen. And so you have all these things going on. So there's a ton of threads running in there. And a lot of people don't understand that. You have a ton. I mean, when you look on OS X, you open up the activity monitor, and you say, what are all these things doing? You know, it's there's a lot of stuff going on, man.
Yeah, that's kind of not even half of it. Those are just the processes.
Yeah, that's not even the threads in those processes. Right. You know, so,
And you don't see the kernel doing its voodoo. So.
Yeah, that's the other thing is that that's one of the differences between NT. NT had this doesn't have a kernel null process. VMS had a null process. Hmm. VMS always had to execute a process because it didn't have threads, right? So it always had to execute a process. So there was this process called the null process. So if nothing else was scheduled, the null process would run.
Yeah. That's kind of how I work, actually.
Yeah.
If I'm awake, I'm doing something. If not, I'm just staring into space, and that's my null process, which is effectively the same thing. Now, would the null process be at, like, when it became active, would it start like a power down countdown for power saving, or is this power management stuff just not this picture
yet? That didn't exist in VMS.
Yeah, yeah.
And the power management in NT, that started being developed around the early 90s, you know, for notebooks and stuff.
Right. Like it gets added to these systems quite a bit later, which is kind of why I'm surprised, not surprised, but why it's remarkable that iOS is so good at it.
Because yes, they did a lot of work in that area.
Yeah, they did a lot of work for the Mac laptops and all that, right? But iOS did a lot of stuff internally to,
Well, when you're building a mobile operating system, if battery is the last thing on your mind, you failed, you know. Right.
Yeah,
and you know we did the same thing at Savage. You know, it was like, what can we wanted to shut down the JVM because when you're executing bytecode, that means you're burning the battery. So
that was going to be my next question. So the JVM, it's really nice because you can kind of just freeze dry that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it'll just pick up where it left off. You know,
so. Which in theory you can. Well, in theory you can do it with a process, except a process on a computer is like we were at the top of the show when we were talking about, the caches on various chips. In order to like stop having to come back to the CPU, if you do it like you can't just freeze dry a process as it is because all of the hardware needs to sort of participate in that because it may be holding state that is important to the program. Right.
What they used to do on VMS was really cool. They had swapping and paging, right? Mm. And had two different files. One was a paging file and one was a swap file. And the paging file was basically your bagging store for data, right? So that you would, you know, anytime you wrote data to memory, if the memory would page it out, right? Mm. And then you would demand page it back in. And swapping was to swap out the process itself because the original design target for VMS was like 128K of memory to support 100 users. And so what they would do, you laugh.
But I hope somebody picked up on how absurd that is because that is just good.
But anyways, what would happen is that if you were running, like you would trim working sets, that's the resident portion of the process that's allowed in the memory. And then when you got to the point where I just needed memory, you would copy that process control block out onto the swap disk, right, and save it. And then if you needed it, you would swap it back in. And then, of course, your paging data would then resume. You still have a small working set, but your data would be paging. So, you had a lot of I/O going on with that,
taking a lock all the time.
Taking a lock all the time. And when you look at that today, you go like, that's absurd. But, you know, 1977, when they wrote this stuff, there wasn't a lot of memory. There wasn't, you know, the I.O. with these big washing machine disk drives, you know, with big giant fire hose, 3-inch cables going into it.
Yeah.
And so there was
No, it's not like this. I mean, these people were not dummies by any stretch of imagination. They were incredibly brilliant. Like, so what looks like crazy today?
Well, you know, like, how,
come on. You know,
even how you load an application or load a program on VMS, mm-hmm. the way it would load, it didn't have a loader. It would fault the program in. So what you would do is you would, it would set up the, paging tables to map the image section. And by the way, OS X, I think, used to do this at one time.
Really?
Or maybe it was that next step. I don't know. I remember.
I believe it. This is cool enough that it could be.
Yeah. So you would map it. You would map it to a section on the disk, right? And then you would execute the first memory location, and that would cause a page fault. And would fault the code into memory, and you start executing it. Oh. And then when you hit the next, you know, instruction that wasn't in memory, it would fault in that section and would throw out the previous stuff. And of course, it's all virtual memory, so you could.
That's just the right way to do it.
Yeah. That was the only way you could do these small memory systems.
Well, the right way. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Right. Without doing overlays, which was, you know, painful.
Overlays. So. Oh my God.
Yeah. Remember those?
Yeah. I remember those from the DOS days.
Yeah.
Was that a thing? Like, besides, I thought I'd chalk that up to me remembering it as just being one of those DOS nightmares.
No, it actually happened on the OS8 operating system for the PDP-8. They had overlays.
Wow. So for the kids at home, an overlay is basically you've got your process running in memory, and then you take a chunk of code and you kind of just also stick it in memory. An overlay, literally overlay what happens to be there. Patching with a
basically
with a chainsaw.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a little bit of code in there that is managing the overlay. Right. And then you have the section of memory that this is what I'm going to execute now. Oh, I'm booting that out and bringing something else in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
if anybody remembers TSR programs in DOS,
oh, Jesus.
Kind of like the canonical, which TSR stands for terminate and stay resident.
Yep.
Which in a single process environment like DOS just means very awful things are happening. So, yeah. I didn't know that idea had got out. It came to DOS from other places. That's interesting.
Yeah, there was a word processing system on the PDP-8 that DEC had called WIPS-8, or as we used to call it, whoops. and it had the 8-inch floppies. You know, remember those?
Yeah, I remember those.
It was on a PDP-8, and it had like it was 32 kilobytes of memory, and so you had to do this word processing program over a 20 mil current loop to this serial thing inside the box, but you would do overlays. So every so often you're typing along and you hit the delete key, and all of a sudden you hear the floppy going doo 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 doo, pulling in the overlay to do the delete.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like, wow, computers are amazing.
That's what I love about that is that still actually happens. Like I mean, you page in a code page rather than an overlay,
right.
But it's
right.
It's remarkable how sort of the hacks and abstractions have matured over time to become like a well-designed whole. Like we've taken a lot of these ideas and we've sort of synthesized them into like, well, this is how things should work.
Yeah, yeah. What I think is amazing is iOS and mm-hmm. what they did to make that fit into that, you know, because like every time I hold my iPhone, I go like, wow, our whole VAX cluster room didn't have this much power. Right. And what I find is amazing is that they can run the programs and there's no paging. There's no data paging. You can do text paging all you want, you know, instruction paging all you want. Yep. You know, so they probably do something similar where they map image sections and just fault them.
Yep.
E2 and all that sort of stuff. But there's no data paging. So, you know, when you get to a certain point, oops, it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah, it's fascinating that they went back to a fixed memory size model, which right. I find really interesting. Little known dirty secret, you can, using mock calls, you can, or maybe even just MM, you can map giant data files into your process and they'll work fine on iOS. So you're not limited to necessarily the size of memory that you have.
Right. So you, the
in
maps,
RAM, you
map
can
sections.
Map. Yeah, yeah. This comes in handy for games a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Where if you've got like a giant data file describing all your textures, you can just mem map that, and you'll get all of the classic operating system paging in and out. So rather than, you know, you'll be back to it. You can't address 4 gigabytes because of the way they do some tricks in the kernel.
Well, yeah, there's
somebody explained to me at some point, and I forgot the details, so I'm not gonna. But it's way more. It's not like a gig. It's like you can get quite a lot.
Isn't it 2 gig?
It could be something. Yeah. I don't want to promise anything, and because I forget, it's a weird number. It's a number that, like, if you look at the architecture, you're like, that shouldn't. It shouldn't be that number, but it is because it's whatever magic, you know.
Yeah.
But it's great. It's an awesome thing that I don't think many people know about it.
Right, and that's great if you're doing databases for games and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not so great if you're running like an Oracle database or something.
No. It's hard. Yeah, but if you if you have a giant database a giant data set that you want to address on in a fixed space, then you can do it. And exactly. You probably want to only do it, maybe you even can only do it read-only. What happens if you write to it? I don't know what happens.
Well, I don't see any reason.
I don't see any reason why it shouldn't work, but that doesn't mean that it won't, right?
Yeah, so. Let's do one.
Yeah,
let's try one.
Did you think of Microsoft moving NT down to Windows Phone finally, or...
Yeah. I think that was in response to iPhone because, you know, iOS, because they said, you know, Windows CE, unfortunately, over the years was hobbled. And, you know, they tried to fix it with Windows CE 6.0. They actually had a kernel that actually had real address space in it. But by that time, I think they had to go to a different approach. And so, you know, there was always this concept of embedded NT. That existed a long time. We did some work with it at B Square, and it was basically you could customize NT. You leave the parts out you don't want, right. You know, and just only the things that had certain dependencies, and you could get it down. We built a window-based terminal product based on it that was very small. As far as it fit into one of those little what became SanDisk, little.
Oh, cool! Drive controllers, right?
Yeah, they were NAND flash.
Yeah,
little NAND flashes that looked like a chip, and it would fit in there and boot NT off of it. And so I said to my, you know, I always said this. I don't want to claim the credit for it, but I always said, well, why can't you put one of this stuff in a phone someday? Mm-hmm. And you know, when iOS came out, I went like, oh my god, somebody did. And so I think that Microsoft wanted to go after the same thing, and it shouldn't be that hard because there's just, you know, there's a lot of all they would have to do in the OS is to get rid of a lot of the dependencies on like bus extenders and all that sort of stuff that really don't care about and trim it down to a very small kernel. I think it's a powerful operating system. You know, if you do that and get rid of all the cruft, that it would be a great mobile operating system. But I think, you know, I think the thing is they were a little too late on it. So
is it too late to get good? Go ahead, Renee.
No, I was going
to
just say that it's interesting that we have all these modern devices running, you know, at least modern reinterpretations of the operating systems, but the kernels are still Linux or the Mac kernel or NT. There's no new generation kernel running on new generation devices.
Oh, I know. That's why we were hoping when we were at Savage, our kernel, we even called it germ instead of a kernel. We called it a germ. Yeah. and we would love that because it was a really small, efficient kernel. But, you know, as our investors told us, well, aren't you competing with Microsoft? Well, anybody who writes software competes with Microsoft.
Right.
So, yeah. But, yeah.
Well,
but,
so is it too late to strip down? I mean, basically, these days, everything runs on effectively a microkernel with sort of a traditional kernel slapped in there, right? Yeah. I guess you could say that's the same. That certainly OS X and iOS are like that. NT is like that.
Is Qunix like that?
Is what?
Qunix like that?
Qunix is not like that, no.
No.
But I don't know what the hell they shipped in in the Z10.
By the way, I have a lot of respect for the QNX guys. I hired a bunch of those guys when I was at B Square, and they were really smart guys. So
great.
Canadian.
No, I've loved QNX for ages. Again, it's just not a practical desktop operating system, or I would have loved to have used it. Yeah.
No, it was a great embedded operating system.
Oh yeah, it was great. Yeah, and even they had a pretty good GUI design tool. They had some pretty good higher level stuff. Like, they didn't go with X11. They had their own windowing system and stuff. When BlackBerry bought them, I was super excited because I'm like, oh, look, you're getting some really great talent in there.
Yeah.
But so can we strip down these? I mean, what's the future of kernels, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you. But that feels like too broad.
I think we're at the point now where kernels are what they are, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And it's all about the runtime now. You know,
sure.
Who's got the best runtime and how fast, you know, runtime. I mean, I love when Mike Ash publishes his Objective-C message send numbers. I just look at that and I smile because, like, oh, look how the A7 is so much faster now than the A6 and stuff like that. You know, that type of stuff.
It's like the way he just dissected exactly how everything's better.
Yeah, everything he puts out is I just absorb and I go, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And
he was our previous guest too, so it's like we're fluffing him twice in a row, you know?
There you go. but he's, wow, I never thought I'd be called a fluffer.
I didn't mean
I think
like
we
that.
Were called the fluffers.
I meant like,
okay, that's okay.
You're going
I think the kernels are pretty much stable. I mean, they're always going to tune them for battery management because that's where the places, you know, in the case of iOS, they're always going to try to improve the performance of Obj-C message send. You know, and of course, the other C libraries that they have in there, because there are a lot of C libraries in there, you know, they'll try to pull out every performance they can out of it. I think you're going to, I mean, like Mavericks, I've got this Haswell MacBook Air running Mavericks. And one day I forgot my power adapter and I worked 10 hours and I didn't lose the battery. And I was like totally blown away by that. I don't remember ever doing that.
Shutting down coffee shops now with the Mavericks at MacBook Air.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So, yeah, I mean, there will always be fine tuning, but I think, you know, I think unless we start going to 128-bit chips and stuff like that,
But even then, I mean, I don't want to say the classic 64K is good enough for everybody.
All we'll ever need.
Well, but 128-bit chip is like, I don't know what you gain from that.
Why would you need more than 640K?
Well,
wasn't my Atari Jaguar 128-bit?
Sorry, I understand like very wide instruction words like for processing massive amounts of data. But that's what we've got GPUs for, or GPU type things for. I don't know if we need a 64-bit chip to do that.
No, that's, I mean,
like a 128-bit chip to, you know, I don't know if he needs it like a natural 128-bit int.
No, you don't. The vector units, which are in the GPUs, are just more than enough to do any of that stuff, right? Unless you're doing scalar, right? And you'll have to.
Yes.
You have to stay on the main CPU, but
I'm talking purely about data size. I mean, I think well, first of all, caches, buses, and locality of memory, those all will evolve, right? But I don't know if
data paths get wider, and the less you have to double pump, you know, the faster you get data in. So
I don't think what was ZFS, a 128-bit file system, and they claimed to be able to. Was enough to be able to boil the oceans or something, trying to fill it all.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's an axiom that the co-creator of VMS once said, and when I left DAC, it was on a conference room wall back in New Hampshire at the VMS facility. And his name was Dick Hutsfett. And unfortunately, he passed away a number of years ago. But he had an axiom that even a virtual memory machine requires real memory.
Mm-hmm.
So, because back in those days, people would say, oh, you got 4 gigabytes of address space and 128K of RAM.
Right.
I think VMS 1 went out at 256K, I think. I don't think they could make 128K, but I was I was a child then, so. No, but yeah, I mean, it's amazing to live through the computer. You know, when I was like, when I was in high school, I didn't, you know, I used to hear about these computers that would take up buildings, you know, right. And then I look at what I have in my hand and I go like, oh my God, this is like, you know, better than the NORAD defense system, you know, right. As far as processing power goes. So it's been fun to live through that. And by the way, if you ever want to go see some really cool stuff here, if you're ever in Seattle, mm-hmm. There's this place called the Living Computer Museum in just south of Safeco Field. You know, that Canadian baseball team plays there. they have seriously a PDP-7, the first machine that Unix was written on. They have PDP-8. They have the original Mac 128. They have the Lisa 1.
Wow. Nice.
They have DEC System 10, which was the 36-bit mainframe that DEC did. They have VAX. They have they just have everything there. And I took my kid there. I have a teenager, and I took him there last year, just towards the end of last year. And we walked around in there, and I was like a kid. I was like, look at this. Wow, DEC tape. You know, and I started explaining to him the architecture of DEC tape, and he's looking at me going like, you're out of your mind. Have you ever heard of DEC tape?
I have. I don't know anything about it.
It was just real quick. It was invented by a guy. Originally, it was derived off a thing called link tape, which was developed by Wes Clark at MIT for the link computer. But this guy named Tom Stockybrand at DEC created a two-way file-oriented tape. It wasn't record-oriented. It was file-oriented. He had timing tracks and things, and it would go back and forth. You could boot an operating system off the tape faster than you could on a floppy.
I don't know if you could boot from it. I did know that it was a crazy tape that was file based rather than being record based.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Yeah.
Again, record based tape is what you.
Well, most people
use for kids. It's like you just write a bunch of structs out to tape. Okay. But this one had a file system on it, which is bananas for a tape. It's like it's crazy.
Yeah. It was insane. Yeah. The old days of computer science and. Now we've coalesced down to these smaller things, and you know, yeah.
I think we're done now. Nothing interesting left.
Yeah. What about OS 11?
10.10.
I was 10.10. Yeah. I don't think they'll ever. Do you ever think that they'll catch the iOS kernel up to the OS 10 kernel? Because they're like a couple of revs behind. Because I think we're at Darwin 10.
And that's where we're at Darwin 10.
Cut that out.
No. No, I think they'll always be different because I think they'll always be – as long as the devices are different, the kernels will be trying to address different goals. I think they will converge in a lot of ways, but I think there will still be things that are going to be different about them.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
If only because, and you know, maybe the iOS kernel makes it up into the laptop line, but like a Mac Pro, maybe they've got a bit of a different kernel. Like,
do you know, I made a prediction about a year ago that they would have an ARM based OS 10 based MacBook Air at some point in time. And I really hope they do that because I think that's the way to achieve the battery life. I mean, you're talking 15 to 18 hour battery lives.
Yeah.
When you're not executing, you know, you don't have a VM executing RISC instructions underneath an x86
I know. I agree. The pain point these days is not really how fast most things are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, CPUs especially. Data paths always need to, you know.
Yeah.
The power drain is just that's the thing that needs to get fixed at this point.
Yeah, the only thing I want faster is how fast Xcode will error to me. Instead of waiting 3 minutes for the error, how about 2.5? Would that be better?
But come on, when we started talking, you were writing assembly for PDP.
Oh Jesus, yeah.
So you know, count your blessings.
It's so funny at work when you there's a couple guys at work who, you know, been around for a bit, and it's fun to talk about that. But the younger guys, they all look and go like, huh? it's funny. It's funny. So
kids these days.
Back in my day, I had to walk the bits across the mountain in bare feet just to get milk.
Oh, my cereal shifter was 36 microseconds.
Kids.
So anyways, that's, you know, like I said, there's all the NT stuff is based on my experience. You know, other people may have different, you know, opinions on how the process went or who, what the politics were.
I think anybody that listens to the show understands that the conceit is that, you know, we put a mic on the table and we just have a chat.
Yeah.
This is not meant to be a paper of record kind of accounting of anything. So
it's bar talk.
So if I get a summons tomorrow, you'll, you know.
Both Canadian, so good luck.
I know. Yeah, I know.
If Gates has a problem, he can come on the show.
Yeah. If Bill wants to come yell at us, or Dave Cutler.
I think he's too busy nowadays, you know.
Being awesome.
Awesome. I mean, he's you know, I always had a respect. Like I said, I met him in like 1987, and I was impressed when I talked with him. Really smart guy, you know, and he probably wouldn't remember me from a hole in the ground, but you know, still I was very impressed by him, and that's probably why I wanted to do what I did, you know. And so, cool.
Yeah. You're in his mind palace. Don't worry.
Yeah, I met. Yeah.
Heard, you know, he's everybody who tells stories about him says that he's impressive,
because
there's no way you could have done that, or anybody could have done that, without being incredibly smart. And,
you don't get to be Bill Gates without being impressive.
You know, I spent a lot of time being like, oh man, you're kind of an asshole, just because, you know, the 90s kind of sucked in a lot of ways because of Microsoft policies. But
you know what? We're in the what decade are we in? Oh yeah,
it's like 2030 by now,
something like that.
We're the teens. But
it's like long past.
So Apple's riding high. Okay, right.
Exactly.
And so you saw today, you know,
the earnings report.
Yeah, and the earnings report to me as a shareholder, I go, well, that's pretty good. At least they're not failing. And then everybody else is like, they're failing. You know, and it's like, I don't get that, but. You know, I'm happy. So
I don't like to, you know, as complicated as the systems we discuss.
Yeah.
At least yours are based on logic and reason.
Exactly. Like the market, the stock market just,
based on panic and perception.
Well, I mean, there's no system. There's just mass insanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why they call
on
it
risk. On that happy note, Jeff, where can we find you? Where can we find you on the interwebs?
I am Jeff MC on Twitter. I'm Jeff MC on app.net. I hold the blog at jeffmcleeman.com, which probably hasn't been updated in 6 months because I've been moving. And
you're way ahead of Joe Hewitt.
Yeah. So, so that's where you can find me. I'm also usually hanging on an island in Washington State and occasionally veer off to see all the other population. So it's
good people there.
Yeah, we have some, you know the community in Seattle, and I think you guys know that it's amazing, the Mac/iOS community up here. Obviously,
my business is based in Seattle, Washington.
Yes, I know your business partner.
Yeah,
so
Chris Parrish.
Yeah.
Yes, I had drinks with him the other night, and
well, that's kind of what he does. That's his business.
I would never say that. And of course, you know, I try to contribute to the fine folks with Black Pixel, which they're incredible people. I mean, every time I meet a new one, you know, that I haven't seen, or if somebody's coming from remote, I'm just so impressed. I'm like, you know, it's like, God, I get to work with these people. This is amazing.
Yeah, so, there's a bunch of great people there. And you,
Pascal,
grown,
and his
right?
giant kung fu sword kind of intimidate me, so I'm going to agree with you.
you're at what now? Like 50, 60 people?
Oh, God, I don't know where we are. I'm north
shocked,
of...
So it turns out Rick Fillion lives in Montreal now, and we met up.
Yeah, we won't... yeah, okay.
You won't disclose Fillion.
No, we don't admit that. Yeah,
I don't blame you.
No, Rick's
I hate that guy.
By the way, if you want an alpha fanatic, that's the guy.
He's an everything alpha fanatic.
Oh yeah. Well, he gave a presentation to us the other day on OpenStep to OS 10. Amazing presentation. I was just totally blown away by it.
He gave the same presentation for us at Cocoa Heads. Is it Cocoa Heads?
Yep.
And his brief, whatever the hell it is. Yeah, Cocoa Heads. Yep, it was great when he basically implements the same app on both platforms.
That was amazing. I was like, wow, that was cool. So
smart guy.
Rick. Well, anyways, hey, thank you guys. I hope I wasn't like.
No, that was awesome.
You know.
No, that was wonderful. I had a really great time chatting.
Yeah, and like I said, I just really wish, you know what would have been a great combination? Next step on an alpha. That would have been cool. That would have been actually cool. So, but it wasn't meant to be. So,
well, you should get on that.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to get right on that.
Your retirement project.
I love doing architectural ports. I live for that. That's insane.